Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa presents Colorado-based multidisciplinary artist Lale Mayrin in the Fagan guest lecture series tonight at 7 o'clock on the TU campus. The Iranian-American artist is highly influenced by Islamic art forms like geometric and arabesque decorative forms, technology's intersection with art, and human and natural geography. She merges these interests to create thought-provoking and interactive art installations that involve 3D printing, laser technology, robotics, video, and more. You can see examples of her work at lalemayrin.com. Her work has been shown at the Next 5 Minutes for Tactical Media Festival in Holland, the European Media Arts Festival in Germany, Ponte Futura in Italy, as well as museums around the country, including the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh, the Andy Warhol Museum, and the Denver Art Museum. She'll be speaking tonight about her work and the thought that goes into it tonight at 7 at Tyrrell Hall Auditorium. And she's our guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Lale Mayrin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're going to be speaking at the University of Tulsa, and what really becomes apparent in your artwork is, one, a true fascination with technology and absolutely deep interest in technology, but also geography. And, of course, there's all this undercurrent with, and not undercurrent, it's overt, this interest in the Islamic art of geometry, of calligraphy, and arabesque, the sort of geographic part of Islamic art that is so dominant in building and architecture and detail work, if you will.
Yes, you've completely understood my inspirations. I was born in Iran, but have lived most of my life in the U.S., and I'm deeply inspired by both Eastern and Western philosophies and aesthetics. And what I find amazing is the way that they can come together in really powerful ways that enable a viewer, especially with my works that are more interactive and installation-based, so you are immersed in it, to have a deeper understanding of our connections with geography and borders and boundaries and deep ideologies that basically make us who we are.
Now, what led to that interest in geography, though?
We moved around a lot when I was younger. My parents were scientists, and they went in a lot of places for Fulbrights and studying in Germany and in the U.S. And so I was always fascinated with how, when you change location, even though you are potentially the same, everything shifts, and based on that, you are no longer perceived as the same. And so this internal, external understanding of how basically borders, countries, geography dictates, not always in a kind way, who you are has always been of great interest. When I was a kid, nobody knew what Iran was. They thought Persia was beautiful and it was cats and rugs, and I was treated very well. And then obviously, as Iran came to light in a very negative way in the U.S., my treatment from others changed dramatically, and so I used geography as a way to have a conversation about people versus governments and politics.
You left Iran, I guess, during the revolution, so that was probably one of the real low times, but you really didn't experience a lot of discrimination at that point. Was it later, once Iran becomes back involved with the United States, say in the 90s and early 2000s? Or
no, unfortunately, I got here right at the start of the Islamic Revolution. So we left, and immediately after a year of being in the U.S., the hostage crisis occurred.
Right.
And I was, in junior high, but it was rough. It was,
I can imagine.
Yeah, kids are not the most, holistic in understanding matters anyway. It was really pretty awful. And growing up in Miami helped a little bit because there was diversity in kind of ethnic look, but it was still very, very difficult and has continued to be. And again, it's really critical for me to have this voice and be able to share what it means to be from two different cultures and be deeply, in some ways, embedded in both.
Now, the other, the first thing I mentioned was technology, the use of technology.
Yeah.
It looks like you have 3D printers involved. You're all sorts of technology that's involved in a creation of one of your works.
I am. I heavily use technology in ways. For me, they're invisible tools. I use them to allow a way of interaction that in other ways doesn't always happen. I started my creative career in photography, and I still do love that medium. But what I found was most important to me was the shifting understanding in a space. And so because of that, I really wanted to use technology to be, for big bad reasons, like Big Brother, but also for amazing reasons that a lot of technology helps us extend life, for example, have this presence that was both benign and opposite ways of intrusion into our lives. And so I do. I heavily use technology in 3D printing and just even like what's even considered traditional video works at this point, and using lasers and all kinds of infrared monitors to understand presence. And so it's quite integrated for me, and it feels, hopefully for the viewer, most often that it's, even though it's present and was used, that they are still primary in the works. My work is not about technology, even though I very much acknowledge it and use it as a way to sometimes hide behind other ideologies that can not be as forgiving. So using technology as a voice to talk about very difficult issues.
Now, one of your most recent solo pieces was Transitional Fragments, which is, it's really kind of interesting. It gets into this heart of using technology and this interest in geography, because as you look at these pieces, they look like they're 3D printed, but they're wall pieces for the most part, and they sort of mimic, it could be a topographic detail. It could be the 40,000 foot view as you're traveling in the west, or even in the east, where all of a sudden mountains just become fuzzy humps.
Yes, that was an amazing opportunity. It's a collaboration with Christopher Coleman, and it was created for a commission for the University of Denver as they reopened the library. And it's exactly that. It was really important to us to engage, again, kind of site-specific location of understanding a floor that's very high up, and then one was basically or is ground level, and one is beneath the ground. And so we wanted to engage using technology, and those are actually CNC milled, so they are not additive process, which would be 3D. They're subtractive. And yeah, everybody thought they were 3D printed. I think the material and the final output just has that aesthetic. And it's exactly that. We had clouds with little buildings sticking out of them to talk about what it means to be in the clouds and in some ways hidden from surveillance beneath. And then we had geographies that addressed everything from movement and transition from languages to religion, to diseases as we have migrated. And then the underground level was quite interesting because we did research and found three natural basins that basically, again, define us as cultures and nations and ways of wealth and prosperity. So it was water, natural gas, and petroleum. And it's bizarre because, you know, I think it maybe it's just my naivete that I assumed, you know, they're in these well shapes, but underground they're quite beautiful and organic. And so being inspired by their original shapes, we created those pieces as well.
Is this the black imagery?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
These are the black imageries. I assume they're like a water reservoir, and I'm not thinking of above ground. I'm talking about like underground, like an aquifer of some sort.
Perfect, yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So some of the shapes were exactly that. They were water, and then the other two were natural gas and petroleum. And it's just amazing how they reside under the ground, but obviously we can't see them. But they've done so much research. So yeah, the information I found was literally from companies and all kinds of government agencies that basically do that kind of research.
So, and of course, they've mapped these whole reservoirs, you know, and there'll be pockets, there'll be, you know, big areas, there'll be areas where there's nothing and maybe just a little tiny strand. And then when you look at them, they are, I mean, they're very abstract, but they're very kind of beautiful images.
They are, and you know, I feel like we can't take credit for much of that because they're naturally forming underground, but we wanted to have the conversation about what it means to bring these to the surface and to talk about them as means of power based on their desire and their need as well, especially for water.
Now, you actually said you were inspired by like the Mercator Atlas, and I assume if I remember what a Mercator Atlas is, it's Atlas where it's almost tactile, right? Where you can actually feel the humps and bumps of the Earth landscape, but it also is doing everything from human geography, showing, you know, migration movements. I think you mentioned like disease migration, as,
yeah,
you know, as an epidemic moves across, like, you know, the Black Plague in Europe. And you're using these sorts of things to help create these images?
They were definitely inspirations because the Mercator Atlas was such a old and amazing source of knowledge for the time. And to have access to them, our university has one. And going through that with the archivists, you know, they were wearing gloves and flipping it, and I was just taking photos to understand how, I mean, they obviously didn't have satellites. They obviously weren't even capable of going across an entire mountain. But the imagination of what is on the other side or what's from here to, you know, thousands of kilometers away was really inspirational in the ways that now, through our satellite vision, we can understand things, you know, to the micro on the planet. And so we wanted to talk about how imagination and ways of scientific inquiry kind of fed into it. And they're absolutely gorgeous. And the drawings were so beautiful and had so much imagination, like for us now, imagination, although, you know, back then they were considered much more factual. And so they were absolutely inspirational in understanding what it means to imagine walking across these lands or what could be on the other side of a mountain.
Now, those were sort of, yes, imaginary in many senses, but the actual images, are they actual topographic images? So if you're like a geography geek, are you going to recognize some of these landscapes maybe?
They vary. Some of them are much more accurate just depending on
right.
if they have access. And some of them really are crazy fantastical, like looking like the sea creatures, for example, the sections on the water. The sea creatures are really amazing and definitely not something that has been, I would say, on the planet in our lifetime anyway. It's a combination. I think if anyone is fascinated with geography or just even curious, they should definitely check out these maps.
Yeah.
Because they do show how we have been able to start from that point and where we are today.
I want to ask you about another piece, which is HD video that you created. It's called Dominant Policy. This, again, gets back into geography, but it's a more powerful statement on just the role money plays and currency plays. And this is sort of a deconstructed view of currencies, various currencies. You've sort of created into a kaleidoscope pattern. What was the inspiration for this?
Like to and tend to travel a lot, and even as a kid when we traveled a lot, I've always been into currencies of different countries, not understanding their inherent value based on the policies and politics of international exchange, but more because I thought they were beautiful and I really appreciated how they had different sizes and textures, and so I've always actually collected whenever I could, and it's becoming more and more difficult to have a relationship with understanding of exchange in so many ways, including human exchange. And so I was interested in these currencies of how $1 can equal something crazy like 1,000 toman, which, you know, when you're shopping, for example, in Iran, and, you know, an orange costs thousands, it just is so confusing. and the way countries have fallen based on currency inflation and deflation. And so, again, just being really interested in what it means to have a value of an entire country and people based on currencies, pieces of paper especially, is of deep interest to me. And I also find it interesting in the inverse when a currency falls from a country that it becomes, then the value becomes escalated after a while because it becomes a collectible. So it's this bizarre interest in understanding how something has no value, but then after a while it becomes valuable again in more cultural ways. And to break down what the money actually is, playing more with the visual aesthetics of the very intricate patterning and all of the security codes now embedded in the currency. And so the kaleidoscope patterning just seemed like a perfect way to both add to the complexity and deconstruct it.
And because of the worries about counterfeiting, I would assume this is sort of a golden age for currencies now. I mean, as far as just, yes. If you actually sit and look at a piece of currency up close, it's like, to just foil counterfeiting, there's just amazing the amount of subtle engraving done.
And going back to one of your questions about technology, the technology used to try to counter fraud has escalated, and it's quite fascinating, from weaving specialty papers and security threads to adding holograms.
Right.
It's been, definitely amazing to see how countries have had to turn a lot to technology to help prevent serious issues.
My guest today is Lale Mehra. She will be the Fagan guest lecturer at the University of Tulsa, a multidisciplinary artist and professor of art at the University of Denver, creator of a number of really amazing installations and exhibitions. And you can see that at her website, which is spelled LaleMehran.com. And you can see all the ones we're talking about. I want to talk about this really interesting installation you did. It's called Unclaimed. And it's based on this idea that there is this small, I think you referred to it as like airplane paint barrier between the landscape and what would be FAA-controlled airspace that's literally unclaimed.
Exactly.
Now, how did you create this piece that sort of uses that as inspiration?
So this is also a collaboration with Chris Coleman, and we were asked to create a new work for the Biennial of the Americas here in Denver. And one thing that was really critical for the entire biennial was to have works that understood what it means to be global. And it's about the Americas and this movement, more or less verticality of it. But we were interested in how it's not just a binary relationship, because it obviously goes around. And so we spent a lot of time, and we actually developed many, many ideas. And this one for us, we thought, was both concrete and quite poetic in the ways that there is this very bizarre, for now in the U.S., area of land, or air rather, that is currently unclaimed. And it's basically a space where some birds and hobbyist drones are flown. But... it's in general, there is no, FAA regulation.
At least for now.
Exactly.
With drones, who knows if that will be the case always.
Right. I mean, now they all have to be registered, right? Mm-hmm. So that's already shifted. So we were really fascinated with this area of unclaimed space, this area in a way, a last space of freedom. And we really wanted visitors to reengage with the shared stewardship of the space. So the space literally is air molecules that, for example, one person exhales and it goes around and somebody else inhales. So our connection to it is so embodied and strong. And we were excited about creating a immersive space where we made basically a cityscape of 3D printed buildings, and you blew across it and it had little basically sound sensors and could tell you were blowing, and it would activate and ignite both on the ground level of the flooring of this 3D cityscape, but also above your head. So you were in that space. And above your head, we had 192 fans that were correlated exactly with the table. So if you blew in the lower left corner, for example, that's what would activate above you with the fan. So you understood this one-to-one relationship of how you are engaging in the space and the actual repercussions it has. It was pretty amazing. Folks would run in there and drag their friends and basically blow across the city, and their breaths would unite, and the whole fan would also activate, and there was a very thin sheet of plastic above, and it would just billow through. And I have to say, we're really excited about that piece. We believe it was a very successful piece in helping understand something that's quite complicated.
Now, you actually had this sort of cityscape in the middle of the room, but you also had it projected on the wall too, right?
We did. It's so the two projections, the two monitors on either side, were actually the surveillance point of view. So we had cameras, real-time feed from above the billowy plastic to show you a different point of view. So we wanted to provide a perspective that normally one does not have, which is what you see on the ground, as well as the intermediate space, which is this unclaimed area of air, as well as what satellites see above. And again, to hopefully provide a holistic understanding of the relationships that we have, and for now, some of the potential we have to shift that space or to have control over that space.
Now, having only seen still images from this, it almost, at least along the imagery on the walls, it almost looks like the breath shows up as like a fog or some sort of cloudy material. Was that how it was intended, or what exactly?
So on the cityscape table, it does look like a fog or breath. We tried to make it look as close to breath as possible going through. And then the top does have this like billowing, it sounds like waves because of the plastic, and that's above the fans. And then the monitors show what's showing from above the fans. And so it is this relationship of what you do to the table. You literally that second can see right above your head and see above that even, which is what the cameras are seeing.
My guest today is interdisciplinary artist Lale Mehran. She will be a guest of the University of Tulsa, be giving a guest lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at Tyrrell Hall Auditorium about her work. And you can see her work at her website as well. I want to talk about one other work. This is a lot of your work seems very intensive as far as the use of technology and preparation for these installations. But Entropic Order, which is this huge bed of, I think it's actually coal slag, but it's made to look like black sand. And you have this wonderful little pendulum that's, I guess, micro-controlled. But when people enter the room, all of a sudden it moves from its program to create this elaborate sand painting, if you will, again using the geometric forms we see in Islamic art. But when people enter the room, it interacts in a completely different way. Tell us a little about this piece.
So I was really excited to create a piece that had its own autonomy, but also changed with the presence of people. And much of my work tends to have this. This one in, I would say, the most obvious ways. And so it is. It's one of the largest DIY drawing machines that I've, to my knowledge, so it's about 12 by 16, there's 2,000 pounds of black sand, and it's called Black Beauty Sand, and as you already said, it's coal slag. I also love how they name it that, even though it's just coal slag. It does. It draws this amazingly elaborate arabesque pattern. And it's perfect, and it's literally down to the millimeter precision. And what was important to me is to have this conversation about what it means to have ideas that are so perfect and ideas that are amazing for people and are supposed to help. But they're ideas, and they're not actualized, and they change once people enter the equation. And so when this piece is on its own, it's drawing, you know, scribing with this really sharp, solid brass pendulum in the sand, a perfect pattern. And as folks come in and there's little sensors around the big drawing machine and they set it off, the pendulum basically speeds up, and so then it goes into these basically oblong spirals. And what I find fascinating is watching people interact with it. There will be folks who just sit there and watch it, and they want to participate in the ways that they are not disturbing the machine, and they want it to draw these perfect patterns. And then there'll be other folks who are literally running around trying to set off the sensors because they want to see how they can affect the patterns. And what's amazing is the patterns, I find both actually quite beautiful, the pristine, unsullied patterns that have literally no human presence, and also the ones that, based on human influence, have been in some ways ruined, but they have their own patterning, and it's quite powerful in that way.
Well, what are you working on now? Do you have a big installation working on?
Yes, I'm working on a few projects. One is actually a smaller offshoot of Entropic Order, and it's called Entropic System. I debuted this at Carnegie Mellon in last winter, and basically I'm bringing it to a university in Denver. So it's a smaller version of it, and I hope to have documentation up soon. Also working on some small fabrications for one of the buildings here at the Civic Center building, so I'm excited about that. And then the Wi-Fi project, which is quite comprehensive, talking to a gallery in London to bring it there, but also Colorado Springs, and also working on exhibit for the Contemporary Museum in China.
Now, the Wi-Fi exhibit it's sort of a installation that sort of shows our connections with people via technology. Is that right?
Exactly. It's acknowledging that our online selves have really grown, and they do really affect our physical selves as well. That connection is merging quite strongly, and so it's a call to basically just better responsibility in your personalities and your personas online.
Lale Mehrin, thanks very much for joining us. We look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Lale Mehrin is an interdisciplinary artist and professor of art at the University of Denver. She'll be giving the Fagan guest lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Tulsa, speaking at Terrell Hall Auditorium, and the lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.